Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with John Gregory Brown, whose new novel is A Thousand Miles from Nowhere. And Jean Redman, who writes as R. Jean Reed, talks about her new mystery, Roots of Murder. There's nothing I look forward to more than a new novel from John Gregory Brown. He's a New Orleans native. He'll soon be back teaching at Sweetbriar College after a year at Deerfield Academy. But he never leaves his hometown behind. In his novels, Decorations from a Ruined Cemetery, The Wrecked Blessed Body of Shelton LaFleur, and Audubon's Watch, Louisiana has been a powerful muse. And in his new novel, A Thousand Miles from Nowhere, he depicts one man's loss and redemption in the wake of Hurricane Katrina. It is beautiful, it is unforgettable, and deeply spiritual. I love this book. John Gregory Brown, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Thank you, Susan. I'm delighted to be here.
Now, I have to ask, you come from such an old and large New Orleans family. How did their Katrina experiences factor into this writing, or did they?
Well, they did. My mother was still living in the home that I was raised in, that it was our childhood home when Hurricane Katrina hit. And so, like thousands upon thousands of others, she lost her home. It had 9 feet of water for 3 weeks. It was right near one of the canals that gave way. And so my childhood home was destroyed in the storm.
I'm so sorry. You know, sometimes I struggle with these Katrina stories because everyone has this narrative of some kind of loss, which is what you've shown so beautifully in this book. And one of the things you have to face is that people tell you about it all the time. It's like when your protagonist, Henry Garrett, checks into the Ganesha Motel, he's greeted with this, oh, you've lost everything. And that's a terrible thing to hear. And he goes, yes, but I lost it before the storm. So Katrina just becomes a larger backdrop for your story, doesn't it?
Well, it does. In a way, I was keenly aware of not trying to write a Katrina novel, per se, that I felt as though I had things that I wanted to say about New Orleans and about the kind of loss of that place and my debt to it. And I certainly wanted to honor the terrible damage of the storm. But I guess my ambition lay more in taking a look at what happens when a life needs to be reconstructed for any particular reason, and in Henry's case, because of the ways the damage that he has done to his life. So in some ways, the storm is the vehicle that propels Henry forward into trying to kind of put his life back together. And I was aware, obviously, of so many who needed to do that same thing simply because of the storm or for their own reasons. I certainly wanted to use the storm and honor the kind of terrible destruction of it and the ways in which lives were interrupted, if not destroyed, but also to sort of tell my own story that I have in my head.
So tell us a bit about Henry and his slippery downhill slope, his journey from New Orleans to Marymore, Virginia, where he checks into the Ganesha Motel. I would like to check into that motel myself.
Well, you know, it's funny. I mean, I think the genesis of this novel was, for me, it really did begin with my recognizing that I had used New Orleans, the place where I lived my first 21 years and had returned and had family, that I'd used that throughout my fiction, my earlier novels, and that I faced this notion of this place that I had so loved that seemed as though it might be gone forever. And I, of course, I had relocated to Virginia myself and had been living there for 20 years. And so, in a way, Henry's trip is making kind of literal what it was for me. The symbolic trip was to reorient myself toward this new place that was home. And so it seemed to kind of serve as a kind of appropriate metaphor. It was this new place that I had discovered and was trying to kind of locate my own imagination in.
Now, one of the lovely themes of this book is how difficult it can be to accept generosity and how many forms it takes. I wonder if you talk a little bit about Latangi and the Ganesha Motel.
Well, I guess, the wonderful thing about Talk to You, Susan, is that you've identified something in the novel that I didn't actually recognize was there. I think you're right. The idea of accepting generosity, it's a strange thing, and I certainly have seen in my life, and of course so many who lived through Hurricane Katrina and any other kind of tragedy, you discover the ways in which people do emerge and are generous and offer to you something that you didn't realize that might be offered to you. And so certainly that happens again and again in the novel. Having been raised as a Catholic boy in New Orleans, the idea of redemption, the idea of somehow being saved not by something someone has earned, but by grace, is something that feels palpable in my own life. And so that happens. And as everybody knows, that often does happen in small towns, that there are ways in which people step up and become important to you that you never would have expected. And so I feel as though that's happened in my own life. And I ended up kind of creating a character who is in need of that sort of generosity and grace.
And also, you write so beautifully about how important it is to pay this forward.
One of the things that was lovely about writing about him was to try to imagine a character who might be a better person than he actually thinks he is. We know those people who actually may not think quite as much of themselves, but who are able to give things that are surprising and surprise them. And I think I felt very affectionate toward Henry for that reason, because I think he imagines himself a much worse person than he actually is, and others seem to see the potential in him.
I love Henry. But of course, part of the reason I love him, I have to say this, is because reading is so important to him. And works of literary art play such an important role in his redemption. He makes new connections in this new place.
It's the thing, having lived with literature now my life and tried to create it and passing it on to my children and finding their embrace and my students' embrace of it, is that I do actually believe in its transformative power, its restorative power, its ability to develop empathy in us and a way of kind of seeing the world anew. And it is, I kind of realized that throughout my work, there is that notion of art and the power of art to kind of take the damage of our lives and to give us a way in which to start to put it back together again. And in this novel, it's pretty overtly done. And for me, that's, I guess I love preaching that message because it feels as though that's what it's done for me with my own life.
And you seem to feel so much tenderness toward all these characters. Everybody has a moment. There really aren't any bad guys. There's so many good people in this book. And you write about them with such affectionate detail. You give them all a little space.
Well, I think maybe I've mellowed in my old age. I guess I do believe that. It feels kind of schmaltzy. But when you start to recognize the great damage that the world can do, whether through the kind of tragedy of an incident like Katrina, or simply through the kind of workings of the world or disease or all the other ways in which we lose in our lives and we face that kind of destruction, again and again, there is affirmation. Again and again, there are things, whether these are people or through art, that help to save us and help to restore us. And I really did feel as though I was trying to write a novel in which I had a character whose road back to health, to a restored life, was a long and difficult one. And I wanted to try to take him as far along that road as I could and still produce something that felt true to the kind of complexity of our experience. And so I love Henry too. I hate to say that, but I do love him. I love him more than I think he would think that he deserves to be loved. And that's one of the reasons I love him. And I hope readers will feel that way about him.
So let's talk a little bit about some of the music in this book. Of course, there's A Thousand Miles from Nowhere, the Dwight Yoakam song that's the title. And I know you mentioned the Mountain Goats because you're very fond of them.
I am very fond of the Mountain Goats.
And also, the sorrow songs that Henry's father collects.
Yeah, I got interested a long time ago in Alan Lomax and some of the other kind of ethnomusicologists who started collecting this American music and the whole heritage of it. music feels so important to me. Obviously, it's a huge part of the New Orleans experience and the kind of richness of that. And in some ways, it's not until you leave New Orleans that you realize how that music and its distinctiveness and its rhythms are actually kind of been part of the soundtrack of your life in ways in which you don't really recognize. But of course, they're there. And I think it prepared me to have music of all sorts, classical music, jazz, and world music, and music throughout the world, which has been, I know nothing about music, and I feel so much about music again and again. And I wanted to try to capture that, too, as one of the rich components of a life that in some ways we don't, and in New Orleans, I think it is remarked upon again and again, but in so much of the rest of people's lives, it's a profound presence that's kind of unnoticed almost. And so, you know, Henry feels overwhelmed by all the components of his life. And some of them feel as though they drain him and others enrich him. And the music feels that way to him. At times it feels overwhelming. At times it feels as though his head is too full of everything. And in other ways, that's also the kind of avenue for reconciliation, for restoration within him. And so I find music endlessly fascinating. It's one of those pointless things in our lives that just feels so rich and meaningful. And who would ever want to give up music? I mean, it feels like one of those things that we would never, ever want to give up in our lives. It feels so precious. And so I wanted to pay tribute to that.
Well, I love that every time I look at this book, I hear that song in my head, you know?
Well, you know, the funny thing, Susan, is the amazing thing is I confess I didn't even know that Dwight Yoakam song. But this title actually is also the title of a song by Robert Pete Williams, who was a Louisiana blues musician.
Right.
One of the people who was imprisoned in Angola. So it's actually a different song that served as the title. And then, of course, I quickly discovered, and I was actually so struck by the ways in which the lyrics of the Dwight Yoakam song actually apply to this story as well. And I thought that's one of those wonderful moments of serendipity. And I thought, well, that just really works for me, and I'm okay with that.
Oh, that's right. I had forgotten I'd read that. So it is a Louisiana song.
It is a Louisiana song. Well, but the most amazing thing is that when it occurred to me as a potential title, I actually Googled, as we do these days, the distance from this area of Virginia that I imagined was the location of the novel and New Orleans. And it was 1,000 miles. And I just thought, oh, how can that possibly be? But in fact, it was.
A sign.
That was another one of those wonderful moments.
All those wonderful signs that happen.
Yes. Right.
Now, you've had quite a year. Your whole family has. You're moving back home to Virginia after a year away, going home to Sweetbriar. And Carrie's wonderful book was published, The Stargazer Sister. And now Molly McCulley Brown is out with her first book of poetry. The writing Browns have been very busy this year.
It has. It's been an amazing, it's been amazing in so many ways. You know, we left Virginia because it looked as though the college where we'd taught for 20 years was going to close. And so the amazing thing is I had just finished writing this novel when we learned that news. And it was a sort of terrible moment because I'd written this novel about losing a home. Oh. And all of a sudden we then faced losing our home, which we did, and had to move and find jobs elsewhere. And so we moved up to Massachusetts and have had this amazingly interesting year teaching at a prep school at Deerfield Academy, and the amazing demands of having incredible students and just an amazing thing. But also contained within that year was this loss.
Right.
And we had thought that we would be gone forever, that this was it. But the alumni and the faculty and staff came in and saved the college. And now we'll be returning there. And so it is almost too good a story to be believed.
Yeah.
Which is that having lost again, we're then getting this place that had become our home back to us. And for our children, which was so devastating as well, even though they've grown, that we're losing our home, just as I had lost my childhood home, that we're now able to go back has been an amazing source of joy for them and for us. And obviously with our daughter, Molly, who's a poet, having that experience, and our daughter, Olivia, who's now going to have babies, so we're going to become grandparents. I mean, talk about the changes in life. It's just been such an amazing transformation for this family, too. So, yes, this is indeed a good time for the
Browns. You deserve a good time. Let's have it all come full circle, you know.
Thank you so much.
Oh, we've been talking with John Gregory Brown, whose new book is 1,000 Miles from Nowhere. You can meet him Thursday, July 7th at 6 at Octavia Books. John, thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan. That was such a pleasure.
7 miles from nowhere. Then run right, darling, and it's little one horse time.
Gene Redman has a pretty demanding day job as the Director of Prevention for the No AIDS Task Force. And beyond that important work, she's written 8 novels featuring private investigator Mickey Knight. And now, under a pseudonym, R. Jean Reed, her 9th novel called Roots of Murder. She's a 3-time Lambda Literary Award winner, that prestigious award for LGBTQ writing, in 1996 for The Intersection of Law and Desire, in 2010 for Death of a Dying Man, and in 2013 for Ill Will. Hi, Jean. Welcome back.
Hi, Susan. It's so good to be back.
So, a new beginning.
A new beginning, yes.
Is this the start of a new series?
Yes, it is.
Is that the reason for the new name?
Yeah, it was that, and also just sort of separation. You know, it's like brands. People recognize this name as this writing this book about, you know, Private Eye in New Orleans, and to change it to, you know, newspaper editor in a Mississippi small town, my publisher said, why don't you pick something a little bit different so that way there's no preconceived notions among readers, and particularly among people ordering the books, because a lot of times booksellers will order books based, oh, this is how much they sold last time.
What made you feel the time was right for this change in setting and character? You've been writing a long time.
You know, as a writer, obviously I'm never going to be rich. So I had to find some other challenges for me besides thinking how to spend all that money. You know, oh, air conditioning bill, it's spent. So I thought, what do I do as a writer? How do I challenge myself? And the books that I've been writing were the more traditional private investigator first person narrative.
Yeah.
So far, they've all been in the first person. And I thought, okay, let me write another book. And, you know, readers are so used to different voices and stuff, they don't realize, I think, what a challenge it is to say, okay, I'm going to move from this perspective in this person's head and then start telling this story this way. And how do I capture the voices? How do I capture the other characters that I'm not talking about? How do I do this? And also, this was a story I wanted to tell. And my private eye just wasn't the right vehicle to tell this particular story.
So tease us a little bit with the plot and tell us why this story is the one you wanted to tell.
Well, I grew up in a small town in the Gulf Coast of Mississippi, and the main character is someone that my mother might have been in a wholly different life, that my mother was born in 1920, the year women got the right to vote, and she was a journalist working after the Second World War, and the youngest of 8 children, the first one to go to college, you know, and she said that at the time that when she was growing up, her choices as a woman to be a job was she could be a teacher, she could be a secretary, and that was kind of about it. And when I was going to college, she talked about all the different choices I had. She said, you know, it'd be so nice to have had those. And I thought, wow, that would have been interesting. And so taking that into a whole different realm, and like I said, growing up in Mississippi, you know, looking back at some of the past of Mississippi and growing up in there, because some of the things that I did in the research that I did, suddenly realized what kind of life I was living. And as a child, you live in these small little increments of your backyard and maybe the neighbor's backyard and going down to the beach. And I'm realizing that my memories of that past were sealed off from so much of what was happening. The beach that I went to as a child was segregated. You know, the schools I went to, I remember the schools being desegregated. And then doing the research, finding out that Mississippi fought all the way to the Supreme Court. And it wasn't until the year 1969 that they finally lost every single court battle they had, and they had to integrate the schools. You know, and that was my childhood. That was my growing up. I grew up in this era. So how do I look back at it? How do I try to come to deal with it and start to incorporate that into a fiction that hopefully hopefully, you know, people will read. A lot of the research I did, a lot of the things that happened in this book, you know, of course, are fictional, but they're not out of character. They're not out of solely out of bounds of the things that were happening back then. Certainly, we know about the number of people killed, but below that, some of the other things that were going on that we can look at now and say that was evil to try and, you know, do that to a person, even though it didn't kill them, it was still evil. And I really wanted to write about that and to make sure that write about it in a way that talks about the resonances the past have in our present.
Well, one of the things I love about this book is that it's in the great tradition of Southern writing because it is talking about literally bringing up the past. Yes. When these bones of people who were murdered during the civil rights era are unearthed. And your main character, Nell McGraw, is a grieving widow alone with her two kids in this small town.
Yes.
Trying to run her late husband's newspaper. And that's just a great setup. It is, because it puts her in touch with everybody.
Right. Yes, it does. You know, and it also put her in a moment of crisis in her life. She's got her own personal crisis that, of course, is part of the element of the plot of the story. But it's how do you reconstruct yourself and at the same time is search for justice? Because that's oftentimes what we, you know, I think we can look at some of the things going on today and say, how do we continue to search for justice even amidst all the other things that we're doing in our lives? And so I wanted to put that setup. She's in crisis. She's trying to find herself. She's had this life that she thought she'd always have, and now she doesn't have it.
Well, I have to say, one of the things I love most about this book is that the newspaper matters so much. It matters so much to the politicians.
Yes.
And the townspeople.
Mm-hmm.
And they all come in and they want their little time in the sun, their little bit of the front page.
Yeah.
Which made me incredibly reminiscent, as you can imagine.
Back to the newspaper day.
Yes.
Well, you know, I don't think I was exaggerating too much, but, you know, small town paper, this is it. This is the one place that you're going to get a spotlight in a town. You know, I don't want to make it a tiny town. It's not 500 people. It's 1,000, you know, probably 20,000, 30,000 people. But still, the New Orleans Advocate is not going to be covering stories about this. So if you're having a political election in a town like this, which is one of the plot points,
yes,
where else but on the local paper are you going to get that kind of coverage as someone who's running? And particularly if you have ideas you want to get across, you know, that's the only place you're going to get coverage.
So what kind of research did you do about putting out a paper like that?
It's a little bit difficult. I obviously did a whole bunch of stuff online. Like I said, my parents were journalists, but obviously that's way outdated. You know, their experiences, because it was before the era of computers. You know, I asked a few friends stuff. And a lot of it was just thinking, okay, what are the logistics of this? Let me fully imagine it. If I had to run a paper for this size, about how many people would I need? What would be a reasonable thing? And obviously there's a core staff, but I wanted to make it clear that there are people outside that do other things. You know, the stringers are all this sort of stuff. Although with the focus, of course, is on the core people, there's a lot more going on. I mean, some of the really challenging part was the technical aspects of how do you really print a paper in this day of digital ages. There's not a how-to book out there. I know I read the biography of Katharine Graham, which is fascinating.
Yeah.
You know, it's just trying to start read about newspapers and how do they get put out? And how do people think about asking the news and trying to create stories, particularly researching stories?
Well, I have to say that I think that core group, they're all such eccentrically wonderful characters in their own right, you know, and that's a nice setup. I can't wait to see what happens going forward with the newspaper staff. And the other thing I think you probably really enjoyed was doing all the forensic research. That was fascinating to read.
Yeah. Well, you know, again, I have to make it right. And, you know, I've done a lot of forensic research for some of the other books that I've written.
Sure.
You know, and I actually have forensic books. You know, it's like if you have guests that stay too long, you say, let me show you my forensic book.
Is that what you do?
Yeah, a few times I've been tempted. But yes, it's like, oh, let's take a look at what happens to bodies. And, you know, but it's important because this is the thing that gives us the details that create the story. And so, yeah, you know, I had to do the research. I had to get it as right as I could as someone who is not in the field, as someone who is kind of coming from the outside and just trying to learn as much as I can.
And boy, you have a chilling cover with those bones on, you know.
Yeah, and that was totally my publisher. They did it. I was like, wow, that's a really great cover. Just striking.
So are you deep into the second one already?
Yeah, the second one's at the publisher.
hot dog. That's great.
Yeah. I have no spare time.
The thing that's so appealing about this book is that you meet all these characters and there are so many directions you can go. It's really a great setup.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious, is Pelican Bay kind of Ocean Springs? Because that's where you grew
well,
up, isn't it?
Sort of kind of is. You know, it's that yeah. fictional, oh, this works, I'll steal it directly from life. Oh, that doesn't work, so I'm just going to create something else. You know, I basically shoved in the Mississippi coast as three counties on the coast, Hines, Harrison, Jackson, and I've basically shoved another one in. I've kind of stuck it sort of between Biloxi and Pascagoula in that area. So yeah, it is based very, very loosely on Ocean Springs.
So how about private investigator Mickey Knight? Do you see bringing her back sometime
in
the future?
Oh yeah, I have the next book is due August 1st.
Whoa.
So it's like, okay, I didn't get a whole lot of work when I have my jaunt in Spain. So it's like, we're going to just have to sort of buckle down and do it.
All right. Well, write fast. I mean, this is a wildly entertaining book. It is such a great summer read. I think people are really going to like it.
Cool. Good. I certainly hope so.
We've been talking with Jean Redman, whose new book, written as R. Jean Reed, is Roots of Murder. She'll be discussing and signing that book Friday, July 8th at 6 at Tubby and Coo's Mid-City Bookshop. Jean, thank you so much.
Susan, it's great to talk to you.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Bill Lofelm signs Let the Devil Out, Tuesday, July 5th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Today's guest, John Gregory Brown, signs 1,000 Miles from Nowhere, Thursday, July 7th at 6 at Octavia Books. And again, Sunday, July 10th from 2 to 4 at Faulkner House Books. Brown appears then, along with Richard Grant, author of Dispatches from Pluto, Lost and Found in the Mississippi Delta. Today's guest, Jean Redman, writing as R. Jean Reed, signs her new mystery, Roots of Murder, Friday, July 8th at 6 at Tubby & Coo's Mid-City Bookshop. The Octavia Books Science Fiction Book Club discusses The Three-Body Problem by Liu Cixin, Saturday, July 9th at 10:30 at Octavia Books. Chuck Palahniuk signs his book Fight Club, Monday, July 11th at 4 at Garden District Bookshop. Tickets must be purchased at Eventbrite. This is a signing only, no performance. Julie Byrne signs The Other Catholics, Remaking America's Largest Religion, Tuesday, July 12th at 6 at Maple Street Bookshop. Neil Bascom discusses and signs The Winter Fortress, The Epic Mission to Sabotage Hitler's Atomic Bomb, Tuesday, July 12th from 5 to 7:30 at the National World War II Museum. And all of July is devoted to celebrating the search for Waldo, the popular storybook character who's hiding in uptown area businesses. Pick up a passport at any of the 23 participating local businesses, gather store stamps or signatures from at least 10 or up to 18, then bring your stamped passport to Octavia Books. There will be a grand Waldo celebration July 31st at 2 at Octavia Books. Other participating businesses include Toast, Blue Frog Chocolates, Crescent City Comics, Stat Dog, Dirty Coast, Magic Box, National Art and Hobby, Britannia Theater, Scriptura, as well as many others. And a big shout out to Louisiana native poet Jericho Brown, author of Please and the New Testament. Brown, who teaches at Emory University, recently received a Guggenheim Fellowship for his continued work. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.